Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Sting stories right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small, and you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small." But he said, "You shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. So who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and remember, it's educational, informative, entertaining, and free of charge. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free General Law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Well, some years back now, a fellow called me from Orange, Texas. And he said that six men had been arrested for contempt of court right in the courtroom and sentenced to 30 days in jail for refusing or failing to stand when the judge entered the courtroom. Now, in most of the states of the United States, there is not a requirement that you stand up when the judge comes in. It's rude and it's obnoxious to fail to stand when the judge comes in, but it's not against the law. But in Texas, they had a statute, and I imagine they probably still do, that requires the people in the courtroom to rise when the judge enters the courtroom. Now, the judge in this case happened to be black, and the six men were all white. And when I asked this fellow why they didn't stand up, and they said, well, because he was black, and they wouldn't stand. Now, that's contempt of court. And because the statute requires you to stand, you have a choice to make. You don't have to come into the courtroom. You could stay out. And in any event, you could stay out until the court is brought into session, and then you can come in after the court's already in session. It's kind of like pledging allegiance to the flag. If you know that the flag pledge ceremony is going to occur, you can simply make yourself unavailable for the flag ceremony by staying out of the room and then coming in at a later time. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses and some other groups are opposed to the flag ceremony. And so, you know, you can stay in the room if you want to and stand out like a sore thumb. Or you can be discreet about the matter and you can simply stay out until it's over. Now, I personally, when I see these kinds of confrontations coming up, whether it's over something political or a ceremony, you know, my sixth sense says, why don't you just avoid the confrontation? Most people want to stand up when the judge comes in. Most people want to pledge allegiance to the flag. Most people want to sing the Star Spangled Banner. They want to put their hands over their hearts. They, you know, they're not opposed to doing that. So once in a while, though, you'll find somebody that wants to test a law. Back in 1942 or 43, the Jehovah's Witnesses wanted to test the law that dealt with the requirement that you pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. So somebody in the group didn't pledge allegiance. I think it was in the public school system. And then the case was brought to litigation. It was taken up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and when the court finally made its ruling, they said Jehovah's Witnesses do not have to pledge allegiance to the flag. And they did it at probably the most inopportune time to test that kind of a law, right in the middle of World War II. And they prevailed. Now, when we look at the literature, the U.S. Supreme Court reports, for instance, all of those cases are losers. Every single case that's in the U.S. Supreme Court was lost by one side or the other. And it was brought to the court for an adjudication. Hey, wait a minute, they found me guilty, and now I want the court to look at this. And so, in many cases, they uphold the law, and in many cases, they overturn the law. But all of them are losers. And so when you lose in court, when you get jailed for contempt, that doesn't mean that the case is lost. It just means that we have to take it to a higher level to get an opinion. In about 90% of all cases, maybe even more than that, the decisions of the lower courts stand because the people involved are satisfied with the opinion of the lower court. If they weren't satisfied, we presume they would have appealed. So if you receive an opinion down here in the traffic court and you don't appeal, then we presume it was a correct decision. You agree with it, the prosecutor agrees with it, and there's no more to be said about it. Now, I hear a lot of complaints from people that say that they're really dissatisfied with the judicial opinions that they're receiving. And I say, well, did you appeal? Well, no. Well, why not? Well, I don't know how. Or, I think it was futile. It wouldn't do any good anyway. Well, if the people who did receive an appellate review of their case and got the conviction reversed, or hadn't taken the case up, all felt the same way, we wouldn't have any appellate cases to look at. If Yoder had said, well, $5 seems pretty cheap to me, I'll just pay the $5 and shut up, we wouldn't have Yoder versus Wisconsin today. Now, in the case of Reynolds versus U.S. back in 1878, if Reynolds hadn't appealed, we wouldn't have Reynolds' decision. He appealed, and then he said, this is wrong, and we want it revealed, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it isn't wrong, it is correct, and here's why. But even when you lose, you learn something. Remember, in the last two programs, I pointed out that in the first case, at the Bliss scale, I lost, figured out why I lost, and came back and won the second time. Now, that case was decided at the lower court level, and from that point on, the prosecutor there at Bliss decided, well, I don't think I'm going to take this guy Gordon into court anymore. I think I'm satisfied with the lower court opinion. So from that point on, when my truck was empty, I didn't stop at the scale. When my truck was loaded, I drove around on some other road so that I didn't go by the scale. I never again had another confrontation in the state of Idaho at one of the scales. It solved my problem. The state was satisfied. It didn't remove the scales, didn't change Article 1, Section 9, but it changed the prosecution and the results of George Gordon, and that's the only guy I was concerned about was George Gordon. I wasn't concerned about all the rest of the truckers in the state. Now, while I'm on that subject of the truckers of the state, let me point out one more little factoid here that maybe goes by the way, and we don't talk much about them. There was a truck driver there at the Bliss scale. One night I was stopped there at the Bliss scale, and inside gave me the red light, and they were checking me over. And so a hay farmer came in. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and he had a load of baled hay on his truck. And he had just left his farm with that load of hay. He was within 50 miles of his feedlot. And I think the law read if you're within 75 miles of your feedlot, but he was closer than that. He was going down, I think it was Buell or Burley, with this load. And he was there at Bliss, and he just pulled out. And when they weighed the truck, it was 81,000 and some change. Now, 80,000 is the full gross load. 81,000 is a little breather that you have there. In other words, they'll let you have 81,000. 80 to 81,000, they won't give you a ticket if you're within 1,000 pounds. But if you go over 81,000, then they're going to fine you. They're going to give you a ticket. Now, an interesting corollary to this story is that in Idaho, if you're a farmer and if you're operating your truck and you're operating your truck from your field to your feedlot and you're within 75 miles of your feedlot, there is no weight limitation at all. Now, what that means, since the legislature says there's no weight limitation, and the usual gross load is 80,000 pounds, this guy could have put 160,000 pounds on his truck. Didn't make any difference. The law provided that for farmers hauling on their truck, hauling within 75 miles of their destination, that is their feedlot. You can't haul it to somebody else's feedlot, but you're hauling it to your feedlot. And this guy was over, I think it was 235 pounds, something like that. It was, you know, 81,235 pounds. So he had 1,000 pounds grace, but he was over that. And so the law says, well, it's 235 pounds over. You got to pay a $37 fine. And so he was complaining to the weighmaster. He said, you know, I'm only over 235 pounds. That's chicken feed. And the weighmaster said, too bad. Here's what the regulation calls for, and you owe $37, and you ain't moving until you pay it. And he made him pay the $37 right there in the scale check. Now, I happen to know the law. I had looked it up. I didn't say a word to that farmer concerning that 235 pounds or the 75 miles or the unlimited weight limit that he could haul from his field to his feedlot because he was operating his own equipment and he was within the 75 miles. I didn't say anything to him because my presumption was he was a sovereign. He was a voter. He was a master. And he had read all of the laws, rules, and regulations. After all, he had a driver's license. He was engaged in commerce. If it wasn't interstate, it was certainly intrastate. And there was a law that exempted him. He should have known that, and I presumed that he knew it, and he wanted to pay the $37, or he wouldn't have paid it, and he would have litigated. And I said that to myself, you know, I said, you know, this guy, if he is dissatisfied with that $37, then he ought to take that into the judge and he ought to point out, here's what the law is and this policeman over here is in error. I find it hard to believe that the Waymaster did not know of the exemption for farmers operating their own equipment within 75 miles of their feed and feedlot. I mean, after all, he's a policeman. Isn't he supposed to read the law, know the law? He's the one that's handing out tickets. So my presumption is that both the policeman and the farmer know the law, or they should know the law. They either knew it or they should have known it. The policeman should have known that this guy is exempt, and the man who was hauling the hay should have known that he was exempt, and who am I to butt into two sovereigns dealing over interstate commerce? And so I tucked it away in my heart, and the farmer paid the $37, grumbling, got in his truck and drove away. Now, that was a tax. It was a $37 tax for hauling 235 pounds too much. Didn't apply to that guy. Of course, if I would have been hauling that hay for the farmer, it would have applied to me. But it didn't apply to me because I wasn't hauling his hay, and he didn't know how to argue his case. He didn't have enough interest in his case to take the time to correct that wrong. It was a wrong. It needed correction. But he said it's cheaper to pay the $37 than it is to take the time to correct this wrong. This is why the police take advantage of citizens so routinely. It's because the citizens take it. The policeman kicks sand in their face, and they say, okay, it's all right. Go ahead and kick sand in my face again. That's okay. So, getting back to the Orange, Texas case, where the six men had been arrested, I said to this fellow, now, if they refuse to stand up because this judge was black, that is, in fact, contempt, and they are, in fact, guilty, and they deserve to serve their 30 days in jail. And he said to me, well, what would be the exceptions to the rule? And I said, well, in that case, you go to the maxims of law. Maxims of law. M-A-X-I-M-S in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, which there's 435 of those maxims. And one of the maxims of law is the law does not expect you to do the impossible. The law does not expect you to do the impossible. So I said, well, what we need here is impossible. So let's imagine for a moment that these six men are all Vietnam veterans. All of them have the Purple Heart. All of them have been injured in the war. Their legs were blown off. And when the judge came in, these six men had no legs upon which they could stand. That would then be impossible for them to rise when the judge came in. Therefore, it was an error on the part of the judge to find them in contempt for failing to follow the statute that required that all of the people in the courtroom rise. And I said, did these men lose their legs in Vietnam? And he said, no, no. They all had legs to stand on. So I said, well, okay. There's another exception. And it comes under Seeger versus U.S. and Murdoch versus Pennsylvania. And it would work something like this. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that these six men had a religious objection. What if, like one group of people, I don't know who these people are, but there must be pretty famous, they have an exemption in every state in the Union here in the United States that exempts them from getting pictures taken of them to be put on their driver's license because they believe it's a violation of the Second Commandment. Now, there are other religious beliefs by other religious people and organizations that have other types of exemptions. I don't personally subscribe to that. I don't have any objection to having my picture taken. But if I did have an objection, then I would want to make it known to the authorities, and then I'd want a judge somewhere to take a look at that and give me an opinion, give me an exemption. Now, in this case, did these people have an objection? Let's say it works something like this, that by rising for the judge, we would be committing an act of idolatry in violation of the First Commandment by rising for a foreign and alien god. And he said, you know, that sounds like maybe that was what happened. And I said, well, now, if that's what happened, and what you have here is a contempt citation. And so we have to purge ourselves of the contempt, that's with the local judge, or we have to appeal to the appellate court, and this is called an emergency writ of habeas corpus, because, you see, they've only been sentenced to 30 days. And if we file a standard writ of habeas corpus, there's every danger that we would not get heard before the sentence was up, which would make the issue moot. So we have to get heard before our sentence is up. So that being the case, this fellow wrote up an emergency writ of habeas corpus for the six men involved. Now, in Texas, Texas is a little peculiar. They have some very peculiar rules down there. And this case doesn't go to the Court of Appeals. It doesn't even wind itself up by trial de novo or anything like that. So they appeal directly to the state Supreme Court, which, you know, to most of us is a little bit bizarre. But, you know, I guess if that's their rule, that's their rule. So they're not fined. There's another rule in Texas that if you don't have an issue over $100, you can't take that case to an appellate court. You have to go to the Supreme Court itself. This is, you know, that's the Supreme Court of the United States. That's what happened in Brown v. Texas, but this wasn't the case in this case. This case was, in fact, appealed to the state Supreme Court, and they ruled on it very rapidly. The men had been in there for 14 days. And on the 14th day, the Supreme Court ordered them released on the grounds that the trial court erred in not finding a factual basis for their incarceration. That is, the judge failed to ask them, hey, how come you're not standing up? Is it because you have no legs? Is it because I'm black? Is it because you have an objection under the First Amendment pursuant to Seeger and Murdoch? I mean, come on, boys, what's the reasoning here? And since they didn't ask, the trial court didn't ask these six men, well, then the Supreme Court reasoned, well, we don't know why they didn't rise. We presume that they didn't rise because there was an exception to the law, but we don't know until there's a factual determination. So they remanded it. They didn't overturn it. They remanded it for further proceedings to the trial court. So the trial court judge then scheduled the issue for hearing and subpoenaed the six men back into court on the blank day of blank for a more thorough investigation. So on the magic day, the six men appeared, and they were all sitting down in the courtroom, and the judge came in. And when the judge comes into the courtroom, the bailiff says, hear ye, the 14th Judicial District of the State of Texas is now in session. All rise, please. Everybody rises. The judge comes in, and when the judge sits down, he says, now you may be seated. You've probably seen that ceremony. It's pretty standard across America. And so those of us that are somewhat normal rise when the judge comes in because We give honor to whom honor. And furthermore, in Exodus chapter 22, verse 28, there's a statutory requirement by God Almighty himself. And he says, you shall not revile the judges nor curse the ruler of your people. It's against the law to curse President Obama just because you don't like him. And it's against the law for you to revile the judges. It's called contempt of court. Now, under the Mosaic law, if you did this, we'd take you out and stone you to death. Fortunately, here in America, we just sentenced you to jail for 30 days. So these fellows were pretty fortunate that they were dealing with a judge in Texas rather than dealing with a judge or a Levitical judge under the Mosaic law. Now, leaving that question aside, the judge then came in. These boys did not rise. And then he sat down and he said, "Now, your petition to the Supreme Court's been granted, and you've been released from jail, and we're here today for those further proceedings that the Supreme Court has ordered. So today I'm going to conduct those proceedings, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk out of the courtroom. When I walk out of the courtroom, the bailiff is going to announce that I'm coming back into the courtroom. Now, if you rise when I come back into the courtroom, you will be freed and you may go home. But if you refuse to rise, as you did before, pursuant to this Texas statute, 1422-404, then I am going to hold you in contempt, send you back to jail for the rest of your 16-day sentence." So the judge went out, and he was out there waiting, and the bailiff said, hear ye, all rise." And five of the six men stood up. And the judge came in, and he saw the five men standing up, and he said, "Okay, just remain standing right there. Okay. Now, bailiff, these five men that are standing, I want you to arrest those five men and incarcerate them and return them to jail." So the five men that had stood up were arrested and taken back to jail for their 16 days. One man did not stand up. That man was paid $12,500 in a nuisance value out-of-court settlement for false arrest and false imprisonment. I thought it was probably worth a little more than that. I thought he settled a little bit too cheap there, but it's he spent 14 days in jail, got paid about $800-$900 a day for his trouble. Now, the moral to this story is very simple and straightforward. If these five men could rise today, they could have stood up on the first day and prevented this whole event from transpiring. Second, their alleged religious belief was demonstrated to be false. They did not have a truly and sincerely held religious belief, which is required in Seeger. And so the judge ruled correctly. Now, the first time, he made a mistake. He was a little bummed out, and he said, "Well, the law says stand up, and you didn't stand up," so he sentenced him to jail. Now, he made the right decision, but he failed in his duty to determine the cause for not rising. See, he had one more thing he needed to do. If he had done his job correctly, then he would have said, "Gentlemen, can you tell me why you're not standing up? Is it because you have no legs to stand on? Is it because I'm black? Or is it because you have a truly and sincerely held religious belief under Seeger, and you're relying upon your belief as an individual?" And then the men would have answered. He would have fulfilled his duty. And the guys that didn't stand up, probably in that case all six, probably would have gone to jail. Then when the appeal came to the Supreme Court, the question would have been, well, did the judge inquire as to why? And the answer was, yeah, because you're a black SOB and we're not going to stand up for you, which is clearly contempt, and that would settle the issue, wouldn't it? See how simple this thing of law is? Now somebody's going to say, "Well, that guy was a deadbeat. He was a liar and a hypocrite and so on." Hang on a second. The test was, pay attention here now, everybody that stands up will be released. Those who refuse to stand will go to jail. there's a test called truly and sincerely held. This guy had to pass that test. He passed that test. No matter what his religious belief was or wasn't, no matter how hypocritical he was, the test was applied, he passed the test. Five of them failed. Five of them go to jail, one of them goes free. I don't make these laws. I don't make these rules. I didn't invent these decisions. I'm just here as a reporter to tell you, well, that's the way the case came down. That's the way the game is played. And if you play the game that way, you'll probably get the same result. All right, now I've got to give you a reminder while we're talking about this that you're at the halfway point here, and we have to remind you so that we can follow the law here as it relates to broadcasting and all of these various and sundry countries around the world that subscribe to the internet and radio stations and so on, that we tell you who we are, where we're from, and what we're doing. So, you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can download that free General Law CD package by going to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the Archives page, and download her right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, we invite you to go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Well, some years back, my daughter came home one day, and she had a lump on her back. It was actually on her right shoulder, I would say the scapula, and it was a lump about the size of my fist. It wasn't that thick, but it was about that size in diameter, pretty good size, and probably about, I would say, a quarter to a half inch raised up, and it was red. And I asked her, well, what happened, sweetheart? And she said, I don't know. I said, does it hurt? And she said, no. And then I said, well, what were you doing? What have you been doing? And, well, she was up at the high school pool. This is in the summertime. Or the public pool. I'm assuming it's at the high school. And there's a high board up there, and she was diving off of the high board. And I thought, well, she must have hit the water wrong, and she's dislocated her shoulder or something. And so I said, well, let's get in the car, and we'll go up to the chiropractor, and we'll have him take a look at it. So I went up to the chiropractor, and I asked him, I said, have you ever seen anything like that? And he said, no, never have. And I said, well, what do you think of that? And he says, I don't know. Let's take an x-ray. And so he x-rayed it, and he looked at it, and he said, I don't see anything wrong with the bones. But he said, this is something that needs to be taken over to St. Al's or St. Luke's and to the ER and have them look at it. The law requires now that when you have a child that has some kind of a physical disability or ailment or something like that, that you take them to the proper medical authorities. Now, I should point out that this girl has a birth certificate, and I had a marriage license, so there was little doubt as to who the owner of the child was and who the state's babysitter was. Now, the law requires now that you take them in for proper medical treatment. Now, the chiropractor at that time, this is about 1980, and I think it was a little after that chiropractic became legalized. Up until that time, I'm pretty sure that chiropractic was still on the illegal list, or certainly not approved medical procedures list. So I took her back home, and I called my friend Bob, and I said, Bob, I think we have an opportunity here to kill two birds with one stone. Number one, my little girl has a lump on her back, and the law requires that we take her to St. Al's for a medical observation. Now, at the same time, we have an opportunity to test one of the issues that we wanted to test concerning who pays for this. Is it the state? Is it the insurance company? Is it the parents? And in the case where the parent does not own the child, does the state pay for the medical services of their children? Now, the ordinary rule of thumb is a parent takes his child to the hospital, signs the admission form, and the signature on the admission form is used as prima facie evidence that he authorized the services and wants to pay for those services. So I said to Bob, would you come over, please, and pick up my little girl and take her over to the hospital? So he did. He came over. It was about 7 o'clock and took the little girl up to the ER. And when he brought her in, he said to the receiving nurse, this could be a case of child abuse. Now, the law in Idaho, when a medical professional hears the words child abuse, or could be, or maybe, or suspects that there could be child abuse. In other words, a child comes in and they've got bruises on them, or they've been beat up or something like that. Medical professionals are supposed to alert the police. Now, in this case, my friend Bob alerted the nurse by saying, this could be. Didn't say that it was. He said, this could be a case of child abuse. And then he left. Now, once the hospital has been informed that there's a potential for child abuse, the medical professional cannot release the child. They must call the police immediately. And they did. And the police came out and interviewed my daughter and asked her, well, what happened here? Did your daddy or mommy or somebody beat up on you? And she said, no. How'd you get that lump? I don't know. Now, has your daddy brought you here to the hospital? My little girl's 11 years old now. Has your daddy brought you to the hospital No, my daddy didn't. It was his friend Bob. And they were trying to build a child abuse case, but the little girl just told him, no, I can't remember my daddy beating me up, you know, at least not recently. So they went ahead and admitted her, and then the next morning, it was on a Friday night, so next morning, about, well, I'd say 9 o'clock, I went up to the hospital, and I went in and I said, my name is George Gordon, and my daughter was brought in here last night with a lump on her back, and I would like to visit my daughter and see what's been done. And the nurse, oh my God, she reminded me of the picture of that rattlesnake that you see on the package, you know, that you see in the drugstore, where the, you know, where they're trying to sell you suction cups, you know, in case you get bit by a poison snake. You know how the snake is coiled up and then reared up, and its fangs are showing, and there's drops of venom coming off of the fangs? That was an exact picture of this nurse. Yeah. She looked like a rattlesnake with venom dropping off of her eye teeth. And she was very curt. Well, you know, when you're dealing with a child abuser, you know, you get a little curt. I'm not quite sure why she thought that I was a child abuser. Just because somebody said this could be a case of child abuse. I don't think she had any evidence that there was any child abuse, but I guess she must have had it in her head that there probably was. Well, in any event, she handed me some papers that they had there on the desk, and she said to me, you have to fill these out before you can visit your daughter. Now, since there was quite a few papers there, I said, well, would it be all right with you if I went over and read these first? And so she pointed to the couch, and I mean, she was rude, nasty, obnoxious. I went over and I sat down. I started reading these, and now I'd like to recommend to all of you good folks out there, if there's any way that you can get hold of a hospital admission form, you probably won't be able to go in and ask for one and get it, because I don't think that they want anybody to see them or read them. Now, in those days, my eyes were quite a bit better, and I didn't need my lawyer glasses that I have here, my 10-power loop that I use to read legal process. I could read pretty good in those days. And so I went over and sat down. I pulled out my ballpoint pen, and I started underlining the clauses in the contract that I thought were objectionable. And the more I read, the more lines I drew, and the more I drew, why, this form looked like it had the measles. And then I started writing in the margins, you know, and then I crossed out some wording and I changed the wording. And in other words, I went through the hospital admission form and I rewrote the contract. I frankly did not like the terms and conditions that I was being subjected to. And when I got through with the form, I went back over to the nurse's station and I said, here it is. And I hadn't signed it or anything. I wanted them to look at it and see if they approved of my corrections. And when she saw that, she just went ballistic. She says, you can't do that. You can't write on this form. You have to sign this the way it is. Oh, I mean, she was really just livid. I thought she's going to have an apoplectic fit, maybe even a heart attack or a stroke. I thought she was going to need medical resuscitation. And so I said to her, well, I'm terribly sorry if I've offended you, but I said to the lady, I said, well, excuse me, let me ask you this. Have you found out what's wrong with Elaine? And she said, no, we haven't. And I said, what have you done? And she said, well, we put her through a CAT scan, and we've put through a number of tests. Some of them are complete, some of them aren't. We haven't arrived at a conclusion. And I said, you've given her a CAT scan and some tests. I said, how much is that? And she says, I don't know. I said, well, how much is the bill so far? And she says, I don't know. And I said, is it more than $500? And she said, well, of course it's more than $500, because the CAT scan was $1,600. And I said, oh my God. I said, I don't want to pay that. And she said, you have to pay it. You're her father. You have to pay this bill. And you see, boys and girls, that's the very issue that we wanted to test. See, I don't want to take my daughter to the hospital. And I'm only taking her there because the law requires it. Now, if the law requires that I take her to the hospital, do I have to pay the bill? Now, I know most of you are sitting there saying, well, of course you do. Well, let's try it this way. Let's suppose the legislature enacted a law and said that you have to go to the carpet store. And you go to the carpet store because that's what the law allows, or that's what the law requires. And then the carpet guy says, okay, we're going to come out Friday and put this carpet in. And you say, well, how much is that going to cost? He says, $3,000. And you say, I don't want to buy it. And he says, you have to buy it. It's the law. So I thought, you know, if the law can require you to buy insurance, you know, your auto insurance, if the law can require you to take your child to the hospital, well, then can't the law require you to buy television sets? Buy carpet? I mean, if you have to buy hospital services and insurance, what's to stop the legislature from compelling you to buy gasoline, automobiles, or carpet, or anything else? So we wanted to test this. In other words, I want to see, can you make me take my child to the hospital? Yeah, I don't deny that, and I did. I complied with the law. But I never signed anything and agreed to pay anybody anything. And my friend Bob, he didn't sign anything. He just said, this may be a case of child abuse, and I'm leaving. Well, the law says the hospital cannot discharge the child, and they have to admit the child, and they have to service the child. They have to provide medical services, and they did. Now, when it was all said and done, the lady sent me over to the office, and the lady in the office gave me a new form, and she informed me also, she said, you got to fill this out, and if you don't fill this out without making those marks all over it, we will not release your child until this is filled out and signed by you. And I said to the lady, I said, well, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion here that I'm recalcitrant and I don't fill this out. And she says, you cannot visit your child until this is filled out. And she wasn't whistling Dixie there, because my little girl was in the hospital 6 days, and I never did visit her in the hospital. They wouldn't let me in. Now, they let her mother in, and they let her sisters and brothers in to visit her, and never did let me in. Not once. So that's one thing we learned there. Now, the other thing that was of interest here was that if you don't fill that out, this little girl is not going to be released from the hospital till it is. And I said, well, she's 11 years old, and she's in room 437. Does this mean then that the little girl is going to be sentenced to 10, 20, 30, 50 years in the hospital? Does she ever get to have visitors? Can she ever get married and have children? Does she go to school, or do they send a tutor over here to teach her here in room 437? I mean, you mean to tell me that if her daddy doesn't sign this, the little girl is going to be sentenced to life imprisonment in the St. Alphonsus Hospital? And the lady didn't answer me, but I thought I would ask the question, because that's what it sounded like to me. So I left, and some days went by, and finally, the following Thursday, we got a call in the morning, and it said, come pick up your little girl. So I told my wife, I said, leave her right there in the hospital. Don't go pick her up. Leave her there. Let's see what they're going to do with her. It was my understanding that the little girl couldn't leave until I filled out the papers. I wasn't ready to fill out the papers yet, and I wanted to see, well, how long will they keep her there? Well, my first wife couldn't stand the suspense, so she jumped in the car, ran up, and got her little girl and brought her back home. So we did not get to test that portion of the event. So I can't tell you how long they were going to hold her there, because they said, come and get her, and so my wife did. Now, I told my wife, I said, now don't sign anything when you go up there. Now, don't sign any promises to pay or anything like that. And she didn't. But they didn't offer her any either. They just wanted to get the little girl out of there, and they succeeded. Now, A few days later, I got a bill for $8,000 and change. And so I just ignored it, and pretty soon I got a phone call from the hospital, and I said, "That's once," and hung up. And a little while later, I got another call from them, and I said, "That's twice," and I hung up. And then a little while later, I got another call from them, you know, a few days later, and I said, "That's three times, three strikes, you're out." Now, in Idaho, you can only pester somebody over a bill three times. And then from that point on, you can't. Well, at that point in time, I didn't hear from them for a while, and then I got a letter from Action Collection Agency. And Action Collection, they said, "You better pay this or we're going to do really nasty things to you." And so I ignored that. And some time went by, and they called me on the telephone, and I told them that's once. And then pretty soon they called me again, and I said, "That's twice." And then they called me a third time, and I said, "That's three times. That's three strikes, and you're out." And then I wrote them a letter, and I told them, I said, "Now, I don't owe this bill, didn't sign for it, didn't contract for it, and ain't paying it." I forgot to tell you, when I was in the hospital, I told that nurse there, I said, "Well, you better give me my little girl and let me take her home and let her die there, because I ain't paying this bill." And I want to point out that she was in there 6 days. They let her go on Thursday, took her out on Friday night, let her out Thursday morning. And you know they never did figure out what was wrong with her. Now, they sent me a bill for $8,000 and change and didn't know what the hell was wrong with her. And when she came home, she still had the lump on her back. Now, I'm happy to report that over time, the little girl recovered from that. The lump went away. The little girl now is, you know, she's a big girl and got married and had children and lives her life happily ever after. And so she doesn't have the lump anymore. So, after writing the letter to Action Collection, outlining my position, legal position, they sent me a letter and invited me to come to their offices and discuss the matter. I thought that was a wonderful idea. I wrote them a letter back and I said, "Give me a date, time, and place." They did, and it was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the office, and I showed up and I went in. I said, "Good afternoon, my name is George Gordon." And the girl behind the counter, just dripping in venom. I mean, she's just like that nurse. Now, the nurse thought that I was a child abuser. This one thought that I was a deadbeat. Now, I'm not quite sure why this lady behind the desk was so incensed at my presence, but she certainly was. And like the nurse, venom was just dripping off of her teeth like a rattlesnake and ready to strike. She was crude, she was rude, she was obnoxious. And in her case, I said, "Excuse me, madam, I'm terribly sorry. Have I offended you in some way? Have I said something or done something that would offend you?" And she was rude and she said, "No." And so I said, "Well, if I've done anything to offend you, I'm terribly sorry. Please accept my sincerest apologies." Sometimes, you know, you can just smother these people with kindness, you know. She mellowed out a little bit, but she was still pretty hostile. And then she went back and she came back and she said, "Mr. Johnson will now see you." So she took me back to Mr. Johnson's office and we went in. And here was the owner of the company. This is Action Collection. And he had my file. In fact, there was three files. I don't know what three file envelopes had to do, but there was something in all of them. And he had them on his desk. And so he looked at me and he said, "Well, Mr. Gordon," held out his hand. He said, "Mr. Gordon, so good to meet you again." And I said, "Again? Have we met before?" He says, "Yes, yes. Don't you remember? I was in your class at the Mardi Gras, and I'm one of the guys that's in the system, and I, you know, I can't get out." And I said, "Well, no, I really don't remember you, but I'm pleased to know that you were in one of my classes." And we chit-chatted a little bit and kind of refreshed our recollections a little bit. And then he asked me, he says, "Well, why aren't you paying this bill?" And I said, "Well, because I didn't contract for it." And he said, "But you see, when you take a child to the hospital," and he was intoning, you sign an admission contract. And that admission contract is an adhesion contract, and you've agreed to pay the payment. And I said, well, I never signed any admission agreement. And he said, well, you did. You probably didn't remember it. You have to sign an admission agreement or they won't let the child in. They say they won't admit anybody without the admission form being filled out. And you filled it out, but you forgot about it. And I said, no, I didn't. So he opened file folder number one, and he said, well, let's see here what we've got. And it wasn't in file folder number one. He looked in file folder number two. He looked in file folder number three. And then he said, Margaret! Margaret came back. That's the one dripping in venom. And then he said, where is the admission contract? And she said, you have all of the files that we have on this case. They came in from the hospital. He looked through them again, looked a little perplexed, and he looked up at me and he said, how did you get her in there without signing the admission form? And I told him the story about how my friend Bob took him over and how my friend Bob said this might be a case of child abuse, which triggered the statute which requires them to keep the child and call the police and conduct an investigation. And he sat back in his chair and he said, oh my God. That's what he said. He says, oh my God. He said, well, you won't be hearing from us again, and I'm going to send this back. This is uncollectible. I said, that's what I thought. So I said to him, in cases like this, how does the hospital get paid? And he said, well, the state pays them. You see, the first line of collection is from the insurance company. That's why they always ask you, do you have insurance? Then the second line, they want to get it from you. So they want a signed admission form. Then they want to know where your assets and property is and where you work. They'll lien your paycheck and take your house. If they can't get it there, then they go to the state, and the state pays them, because under federal law, pursuant to Medicare and Medicaid, they have to admit everybody that comes in. And they've abolished the county hospital system in America, so they use the private hospitals to do the work of the county hospitals, and they just pay the hospitals what it would cost them to run our own, you know, a state-run hospital. And I said, you know, I thought that was probably the case. I thought the state would probably pick that up. Now, remember the bill was $8,000? Okay, the insurance companies don't pay that $8,000 bill. They have their own private deal with the hospital. Now, I don't know what their deal is and how much they pay. But the final analysis was the bill was lowered to $2,000 and change. So you taxpayers picked up the bill for $2,000 instead of me paying $8,000. And so I thought I would take this opportunity to thank all of you taxpayers out there in America, because you not only paid the bill for me, but you also showed us how the law works in relationship to a child taken to the hospital when it could be a case of child abuse. The state pays. Well, that makes all the sense in the world, because that was the state's child. I was the state's babysitter. All right, I'm out of time. I gotta wrap it up right here and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.